Turning now to the book of Exodus, chapter 1 and verse 7. Exodus chapter 1, verse 7. And the children of Israel were fruitful and increased abundantly and multiplied and waxed exceeding mighty, and the land was filled with them. And the subject is how churches and individual Christians fail or prosper. And the answer to this we find really laid out in this chapter. Now the chapter begins in the Hebrew with an and. The book begins, and these are the names. In a refined way, rendered here in our King James Version, and similarly by most Bible translations, with an alternative word. Now, these are the names. But just to demonstrate that at one time this was all one book of Moses with Genesis, there's a continuation from the last verse of Genesis. So Joseph died and so on, and was put in a coffin in Egypt, and these are the names of the children of Israel which came into Egypt. Now the Lord said plainly, and it's recorded in Mark chapter 12 and verse 26, that this is a book of Moses, and that it was written by Moses. So without doubt, the book of Exodus is by Moses. Exodus, which simply means exit, the book of departure, the going out would be more precise. That's the meaning of the word translated from Exodus. The way out, some people say, in a more modern manner. Actually, their last years in Egypt and the Exodus itself occupy the first 15 chapters of the book. But the book takes its name from that. From the death of Joseph, which is recorded in the beginning of this chapter, 250 years elapsed, perhaps as many as 300 years before the oppression, before the substance of verse 8, chapter 1, verse 8, now there arose up a new king over Egypt, a new dynasty of pharaohs, a change, but that was after a lapse of some 250 or at most 300 years. And that long period of time is given just one verse, verse 7. And that follows from the death of Joseph and all his brothers, his generation, which probably includes their immediate children. And then verse 7 traverses the entire period after the death of the patriarchs and their children to the time of the new king over Egypt. And this is all you learn here, but you learn more in other books of the Bible about that generation. And the children of Israel were fruitful and increased abundantly and multiplied and waxed exceeding mighty, and the land was filled with them. Now the rest of the chapter gives hints that all was not well, and that things had gone very wrong in that 250-300 year period, and the people had become very decadent. Things had declined, and there were some faithful among them, but it was a very different picture at the end of that period than at the beginning, and that's confirmed to us elsewhere in the Bible, as we'll see. All the hints are here. But verse 7, that sums up that long period, chooses only to mention the goodness of God to them and how he fulfilled his promise to them. That's all that's said. Now there is the promise that God would make for Abraham a great nation and many people. And then there is the prediction in Genesis that they would sin and go into captivity, and they would be there for several centuries before being released again. But in that period, in Egypt, God kept the promise of a great multitude, a miraculous explosion of the people. If we were to go into the numbers and the growth of the children of Israel to the time of the Exodus of about 2 million people from 70 or so, well, all the experts tell us that this is unprecedented in any human society in such a period of time. And so we know that it was unmistakably God keeping his promise to them, even though they were wayward. So the children of Israel were fruitful and increased abundantly, and then the superlatives continue, and multiplied and waxed exceeding mighty, and the land was filled with them. They seemed to overflow from Goshen, where they had been settled in the northeast of Egypt, and they seemed to have become present everywhere, earning their living and doing different things. The death of Joseph was most probably around 1800 BC. And now we're into the period after the death of him and his brothers. So God kept his promise. The promise appears in Genesis chapter 12, and it's repeated 9 times. So it's a certain promise, not only to Abraham, but to Isaac and to Jacob. And now it's kept. And in spite of the fact that the keeping of this promise benefited and astonished every family, this wasn't something that was done at high political level. This was something that affected every family among the children of Israel. And so they knew that God was remarkably blessing them and that he was keeping his promise to them. And yet, despite such an amazing evidence of God's power and presence with them, for the most part, they lost interest in him. They disobeyed him, they became idolaters, and there was a terrible decline. So we bear that in mind, that the key verse for that long period of time before the arising of a new dynasty of Pharaoh, God was keeping his promise and continued to keep it even once the oppression began. Now in verse 8, "Now there arose up a new king over Egypt, which knew not Joseph." He was of another order. There had been turmoil in Egypt. There had been a takeover. We're now into another dynasty, as I say, and a long period of time has elapsed since Joseph, 250, 300 years. Well, there can be spiritual things can be totally forgotten. And we see that in our own country. It isn't anything like 250 to 300 years, only 100-150 years before, since everyone in this country knew about the things of God. And churches were everywhere and crowded. And yet, not only has that gone, but most people are utterly ignorant of the Christian faith. And among our rulers, our leaders, whatever party, whatever hue, they know nothing about the doctrines of the scriptures, the distinctive doctrines of evangelical Christianity. They're totally ignorant. So we can see how something can be completely erased from the national memory of the Egyptians, the benefits which Joseph had brought them, that remarkable period of time, and what lay behind it, God's revelation to Joseph. What an impression that had made on the Egyptians. But now it was all forgotten. It was ancient history. And the new Pharaoh, I'm going to skim through the chapter initially and then draw some of the points and the lessons. In verse 9, he said unto his people, "Behold, the people of the children of Israel are more and mightier than we." Now that's highly unlikely that that was a true statement. But then the Egyptian pharaoh wouldn't necessarily make an accurate and true statement in justifying genocide or slavery to be inflicted upon a people. He would whip the people, the leaders of the people, into a frenzy for this. So it's very unlikely that the Israelites were, in fact, anything like as numerous as the Egyptians. It's what an unreliable person says in his political manoeuvring. But here is the purpose of it. Verse 10, come on. He's got to goad the Egyptians into doing this. Let us deal wisely or subtly or cunningly with them, lest they multiply. And it come to pass that when a war occurs, they join the enemies, fight against the Egyptians, and so use that as an excuse, the upheaval, to migrate out of the land and back to Canaan. So there's a double fear, in a sense, that the children of Israel will take up arms with the enemies of Egypt, and that they will go and they won't have the benefit of them in the land and their service anymore. They had largely turned into a nation of servants. They were in service to the Egyptians. Probably now they were treated with contempt as inferiors. In those times, Egypt had great national pride and held any other nation in contempt. They had become, the Egyptians, a powerful empire. They controlled everything, virtually everything, in the known world, one way or another. And they were into building great buildings and cities, rather like the British. Many, many years later, we went into India and in the great cities and the capital cities, put up massive, beautiful colonial buildings. It's what colonization does. It often builds things in order to stamp its authority and to create a great impression. And the Egyptians were into doing that long before. And they were astonishing builders in the ancient world. And it took a lot of labor. And the children of Israel supplied a great deal of that. But now, any notion of peaceful coexistence was going to be brought to an end. There were two objectives which seemed to conflict, so it would require very cunning handling. The policy of Pharaoh and his court and his officers was going to be seemingly contradictory. Keep the children of Israel and turn their servitude, their servanthood, into slavery and into forced labor. We need them. We need them to produce the bricks. We need them to put up the buildings. We need them to go bareback in the fields, to till them and to dig the irrigation trenches, the most elaborate irrigation system of ancient Egypt, which required no end of toil. And that would be worked by the children of Israel. But to achieve that objective, the children of Israel had to be brought lower and intimidated so that they would obey without question and they'd be afraid to break ranks and do anything else. At the same time, there was the conflicting objective of culling them, reducing their numbers because they were becoming too numerous. We want them as slaves, we need them, we want to terrorize them and keep them down, but we don't want so many of them. Well, forced labor was a very suitable way of achieving both objectives. Well, even now, building is a dangerous business, but you can imagine how dangerous it was then, when there were no safety laws, rules or equipment or any such thing. Even in the 19th century, the great building projects of the Victorians cost an alarming number of lives. So in ancient Egypt, the people who had to do the forced labour, the building, there was high loss of life. But still, the loss of life achieved, if I may put it that way, by the Egyptians through forced labour was not as great as they needed. So there was to be, and we read about it in the chapter, the execution. I don't know whether that would have been for a time, a short time, a long time, but the execution of the baby boys as they were born. And that didn't work out. But I'll stick to the order of the text here. And verse 10, and then verse 11, therefore they did set over them taskmasters to make their service and necessarily and unusually rigorous, to afflict them with their burdens, to intimidate them and bring them down. They built for Pharaoh treasure cities, or possibly military store cities, it could be Pithom and Rameses. But the more they afflicted them, God continued to witness among them, the more they multiplied and grew. And every family would see this testimony that God gave of his presence with them, his keeping of promises and his power. And yet, astonishingly, the children of Israel went over to idolatry. The Egyptians had no blessing like they had, but they turned to the gods of Egypt. And although there was one principal god in Egypt, the god of the prevailing Pharaoh, yet it was a very polytheistic society. The ordinary people had many other gods. And yet the people trusted them instead of the true God, who was giving them larger and larger families. And then they, in verse 12, referring of course to the Egyptians, they were grieved because of the children of Israel. And the word translated grieved there is a very interesting Hebrew word, which more means something like this. Certainly means grieved, but it means something like this: loathing. The Egyptians loathed them. They abhorred the children of Israel. And they had, and this is in the word, they had a kind of sickening fear. And other translations translate that not grieved, but filled with dread or fear. A kind of sickening fear. They're going to outnumber us. What we're being taught by our rulers is no doubt true. They're going to outnumber us, and then there'll be trouble for us. And so they despised them, and hatred was produced, animosity, antagonism. And they were grieved because of the children of Israel. And the Egyptians, verse 13, made the children of Israel to serve with rigor. They became more ruthless in this oppression. And, of course, children of Israel were dying everywhere. Look at verse 14. They made their lives bitter with hard bondage, demoralized them in mortar, the making of bricks, and the provision of them, and employed in the building of them, the stone and brick buildings, and in all manner of service in the field, not only cultivation, but that mammoth system of irrigation that we were speaking of. All their service, wherein they made them serve, was with rigor. And all this was partly in preparation for the policy of genocide. Verse 15, the king of Egypt, Pharaoh, spake to the Hebrew midwives, and two are named. Now we assume, quite reasonably, that there were many, many, many Egyptians, because these are Egyptian women, it's plain from the following verse, when ye do the office of a midwife to the Hebrew women, you wouldn't say that to Hebrew midwives. So these midwives are midwives to the Hebrews, they're not Hebrews. And two is quite inadequate for such a huge population, so these are obviously the principles of the whole corps of midwives, and they're Egyptians. And so they're told, in a difficult to translate term, in verse 16, when ye do the office of a midwife to the Hebrew women, and see them upon the stools, which everybody thinks most likely means the kind of stools or low benches or tables that the midwives used for the birth, but there are many other ideas and translations, but that's possibly the most likely, and our translation steers a vague course and leaves it undetermined. If it be a son, then ye shall kill him, but if it be a daughter, then she shall live. And this is not a small detail that follows. Verse 17, but the midwives feared God. God with a capital G, meaning the God of Israel. What are Egyptian midwives doing, fearing the God, the one true and living God of the Israelites? Well, obviously, among the Israelite mothers, there are some, perhaps not a great number, but there are some who do believe in their God and haven't gone over to idolatry and love to talk about God and talk about their history. And the Israelites, the Egyptian midwives, whether they've been converted to this or whether they just have a deep respect for it, having heard this from the lips of Israelite women so many times, in perhaps superstitiously, not necessarily genuinely, they fear offending this God who sounds so remarkable. So they fear to obey Pharaoh. That's verse 17. And they save the men, children alive. And when they're called to account, they, well, do they tell a lie or do they tell the truth? It's generally assumed they tell a lie. And the midwives, verse 19, said unto Pharaoh, because the Hebrew women are not as the Egyptian women, for they are lively and are delivered ere the midwives come in unto them. Is it a lie to save their skins? Possibly, but when you remember God's miraculous blessing upon the Israelite mothers and the numbers of children, it's quite likely that this is exactly what happened. And those mothers were very vigorous, and they did give birth before, so we can't too readily assume that they were lying. Anyway, God blessed the Egyptian midwives for what they did, for having sufficient fear of him not to offend him. And so we're told just a shade later that he made them houses. He gave them large families too. They shared in the blessings of the Israelite mothers in their own turn. So even through the oppression, rather than reducing the birth rate of the mothers of Israel, it was increased by the mighty power of God. Could God speak any more loudly to the Israelites, to bless them in a way that touched every family more and more and more? How God appears to be inviting them. I can see the oppression. I can see the hostility towards you and the agonies imposed upon you. Look what I'm doing to you. So call on me. Can't you find it in your hearts to call on your God and to ask for help and for deliverance? Don't you think that's what God appears to be saying in so abundantly keeping his promise to give them children and a great multitude of people, even in the midst of the oppressive circumstances? Well, verse 22, the end of that chapter, and then we start to comb it again. Pharaoh charged all his people, saying, every son that is born ye shall cast into the river, into the Nile, and every daughter ye shall save alive. So the children of Israel have to be cut down. Now, this is the most powerful nation, Egypt, at that time in the world, with mighty military power. But God is keeping his part towards the children of Israel. The keeping of the promise to give them a great number of children and turn them from a family into a nation, that is taking place. Their history is still taught among them, and particularly to Israelites, the history of Joseph, the remarkable way in which God raised up Joseph to feed the nation in times of famine. And there's a faithful remnant among them. We can see that because even the Egyptian midwives were scared of the God of Israel, and they would have been the ones who had most intimate connection with the Israelite mothers. So there were Israelite mothers testifying, speaking of their God to create that. We look just in a few moments well, not tonight, but in the next chapter, of the birth of Moses to pious parents. So there were earnest believers commended for their faith among the Israelites, and they would be pleading and witnessing. So God was blessing them. They had their history. They had a remnant of faithful people in their midst holding the torch, and yet they wouldn't turn to the Lord. They had their built-in national sense of purpose that they were the people of God, but for all these helps, they wouldn't turn to the Lord. Not for some time. It's after some time that finally, and the scripture puts it in this way, finally almost, they turn to God, and God hears their cries. So here are a number of things that were true of the children of Israel. During that 250-300 year period, there was tremendous unfaithfulness and decline. That's sad. It's not chronicled here. We just get the indications. And one reason is probably this: prosperity. Egypt was such an amazing place. It was so fertile during that period. They were no longer hardy people, the Israelites. They'd gone soft. They'd lost their fibre and their strength, their mental strength and their moral character. They'd become a soft and a pliable people. They were no longer resilient. You think of Jacob. Think of Abraham, Isaac, Jacob, living such hardy lives, almost as nomads, living in tents, going from place to place, keeping sheep for the most part. It was a hardy lifestyle. They were tough. They were resilient. They were strong. But now, nearly three centuries, in complete affluence and ease, and the Israelites seem to have lost all that strength. So, as the Egyptians said, serve me, serve my household, take up this work and that work, as servants and assistants, they willingly did so. They took this up, and when that turned from perhaps paid service into slavery, it was done subtly. Let's deal with them wisely, subtly, cunningly. They didn't see it happening. They didn't mind it happening. They didn't put up any resistance. They didn't stand up for themselves. They didn't call upon their God. So the people whom God was blessing and blessing and blessing with such explosive growth were a pushover to the Egyptians and came into abject slavery and oppression because their affluence and their ease and their unfaithfulness had surrendered all moral fibre. That's clear. But that can happen to churches today, can happen to us as individuals today. Do you like creature comforts? I'm sure you do. We all do. Do you like too much creature comfort? That's a temptation, isn't it? Have whatever I'd like to have, if you've got the means. Make sure everything is as comfortable as it can possibly be. Ease and comfort. But don't you know, it's undermining your moral fibre and your strength. You'll be a weak and a pliable person. Have whatever the world has to offer, you'll be in the pocket of the world. Happens to churches. Isn't it sad? There are dear people of God and churches, but they don't do a thing for the Lord. And they don't take any knocks. And they won't exert any struggle. And they're just happy to drift along and to fellowship and relate, be happy together, and nothing's happening. So it's a great warning. Even though God was blessing the children of Israel, they allowed themselves to go to pieces. Even more seriously, because they were also idolaters, but we'll come to that. So they became a weak people. And you find this today. you say to a Christian pastor, you know, an evangelical pastor, why do you do this? Why do you do that? Oh, I don't want a battle. I don't want to fight. I was talking a few weeks ago to a man who's a deacon in a church which has just surrendered to everything that's going on today. Didn't you resist it? No, we've done too much fighting in the past. We've given up. All the comforts of life, easy going. What happened to them can happen to us. And that's why it's recorded here. But secondly, and allied to it, they were spiritually unfaithful. Also, idolatry. Let me turn you to Joshua chapter 24. I mentioned earlier that we look at other parts of the scripture to see, to be informed about what happened in this 250-300 year period. Joshua chapter 24 and verse 14. Now therefore, this is Joshua speaking God's word to the children of Israel later on in his time. Now therefore fear the Lord and serve him in sincerity and in truth, and put away the gods which your fathers served on the other side of the flood and in Egypt, and serve ye the Lord. So there it is, you see. It was written into their history, and Joshua, here is God's mouthpiece. When you were in Egypt, you served idols, and some of you have still got them. And you better put them away. And then we can go right over to Ezekiel chapter 20. And the prophet Ezekiel in chapter 20 and verses 7 to 9 is inspired to spell it out as he chastises the people. It's God speaking, verse 7. Then said I unto them, cast ye away every man the abominations of his eyes, and defile not yourselves with the idols of Egypt. I am the Lord your God. This is how God spoke to the children of Israel when they were in Egypt. But they rebelled against me, and would not hearken unto me. They did not every man cast away the abominations of their eyes, neither did they forsake the idols of Egypt. Then I said, I will pour out my fury upon them to accomplish my anger against them in the midst of the land of Egypt. And so it goes on. And in the end, God brought them out of Egypt. And it tells us in Ezekiel, one of the reasons was to get them away from the extent of their idolatry. Well, that's deeply serious. That among, with all the affluence, they became idolaters, in spite of the blessing of God. They had lost their distinctive separation from the world. They had mixed with the Egyptians. They had adopted their idols. They were in abject slavery to them. What a collapse! What a decline! And it happens today. In our lives, in church lives, there can be an adoption of worldliness. And I won't go into that now, we touch on it often, but there's so much worldliness in churches today. Then a third thing, there's a loss of prayer. If we just turn to Exodus chapter 2 and verse 23, you see it here. It came to pass in process of time that the king of Egypt died, that particular pharaoh of the first Pharaoh, the first oppression, and the children of Israel sighed by reason of the bondage, and they cried. And their cry came up unto God by reason of the bondage. How long it took them! How long it took them to cry out! So there had been a loss of prayer. Inevitable, really, if you're faithless, and you let the world in, or they went over to idolatry, you won't pray. And there's not much prayer in many places today. We have to be very careful about this. I was talking to a pastor not so very long ago, and I said to him, mildly, provocatively, but so as not to show it, I said, how do you get on with a combined prayer meeting and Bible study? He said, oh. He didn't sense that there was any threat in this question. Oh, he said, well, We start at 7:30. I will preach until about 9:15. Then we have 10 minutes prayer. This is in London. Quite a well-known church. 10 minutes prayer. Well, as generously as I could, I put a point of view to him. But however, 10 minutes prayer. How can you expect blessing with a prayer meeting, a church prayer meeting that lasts 10 minutes at the end of a long, tiring sermon? Well, friends, it's what we have here. Why churches fail. Why the children of Israel failed. They became soft. They became faithless. And we may become worldly. They gave up praying virtually, as good as. And they lost their sense of national purpose. They lost it. We are God's family. We are here to teach the world. We are here to live for God until the Messiah comes, through whom all the nations of the world will be blessed. They lost that sense of any national purpose, calling, or objective. Now I'm just going to turn over to Acts chapter 7, just for a moment, because this is what we're told from verse 23. This is about Moses. You know this. When he was full 40 years old, it came into his heart to visit his brethren, the children of Israel. And as the passage goes on, you know why it came into his heart. Not solely because he thought to himself, wouldn't it be nice to be among my kith and kin? It came into his heart because he knew he was probably God's instrument for leading them out, for prophecy to be fulfilled, and for the land of promise to be occupied. That's what came into his heart, not just a nice sentimental desire to be with his own ethnic group. Well, when he was full 40 years old, it came into his heart to visit his brethren, the children of Israel. You know this. And seeing one of them suffer wrong, one of those taskmasters did something wicked, he defended him and avenged him that was oppressed and smote the Egyptian. For he supposed his brethren would have understood how that God by his hand would deliver them. But they understood not. They're tremendous words. They understood not. They had totally lost their national sense of purpose and destiny and function. What a tragedy. That's why churches fail too. That's why we fail as individuals. We start living as though our great objective is to provide a home and an education for our children and all these things which are noble and proper responsibilities. But we start living as though these are our ultimate objectives. And we forget that our national, as their national, our individual purpose is to represent Jesus Christ and to make him known and witness to him and join with fellow Christians in reaching a lost world. And we forget that. And churches forget it. And the ministers can stop, good men and dear men, can stop preaching evangelistic sermons, and the church can give up visitation, and nobody's doing anything, and they've lost their sense of purpose. We are here in this community to gather in all the children we possibly can, and the teenagers, and to reach out, and to reach the people, and to visit every house. We've lost it. They lost their sense of national purpose. That's the reason for decline, alongside the other things. You can see it all here in this chapter. And then I must start to move to conclusion. They also lost, while I'm open at Acts 7, they lost their openness to reproof. And that's a sure way to failure. As individual Christians and as churches, they lost any openness to reproof. Let me visit read these familiar words from Acts 7, verse 26. And the next day he, Moses, showed himself unto them as they strove, and would have set them at one again, saying, Sirs, ye are brethren, why do ye wrong one to another? That's a gentle enough reproof. But he that did his neighbour wrong thrust him away, saying, Who made thee a ruler and a judge over us? Then he threatened him, Wilt thou kill me as thou didst the Egyptian yesterday? And Moses, the word fled is strong, because he had faith. He withdrew, an expedient withdrawal at this threat, because he would have been betrayed to Pharaoh, and it would have meant his execution or something of that sort. But they had, and this is not just an isolated incident, this man obviously represents many or most of them. They'd lost any openness to reproof. Well, those are just some of the reasons for failure. And we could add loss of faith, loss of personal fibre and character, moral fibre, loss of faithfulness, idolatry for them, worldliness for us, loss of prayer, loss of a sense of purpose and aim, loss of correctability, loss of faith. So that's why I gave this, the title may have sounded curious, Why Churches Fail. Why individuals fail, and why they prosper, because they endeavour to get as far away from these failings as possible. Loss of faith, appropriating power, that's faith, appropriating power. I read familiar words from Hebrews 11 and verse 23. By faith Moses, when he was born, was hid 3 months of his parents because they saw he was a proper child. That doesn't mean because they saw that he had 10 fingers and 10 toes. It means that they knew he was God's chosen. They knew it. They saw he was a proper child, or the child. And they had faith. And they were not afraid of the king's commandment, and they hid him by faith. But most of them had lost that faith. And people have lost faith today. Why are there so many gimmicks in evangelicalism? Why do people run after these missional church gimmicks? Informality. So-called continuism, looking for the gifts today. Contemporary things, drama, every gimmick that comes along. And there are even good churches collapse in front of them and give way to them. Why? It's because we lack faith. Oh, the preaching won't do it. The Holy Spirit and preaching and prayer, that's surely not enough for an age such as ours. We need all these things, these other things. Well, dear friends, this is how we fail, this is how churches fail, and really, it's all in Exodus chapter 1. But I come to conclusion just reading the first verse, and I'm going no further, of Exodus chapter 2. And there went a man of the house of Levi, and took to wife a daughter of Levi, and the woman conceived, and bear a son. And God was going to bring in Moses, and he would lead them to deliverance, and at last there would be a way out. Well, this is the opening of the book of Exodus. We need to keep our vigour, keep ourselves hard, if you'll forgive the term, soft in heart, hard in metal and resolution. We need to maintain prayer, sense of purpose, always to be open to God's reproof, always listen to him, and faith in his provision. Now, just as God blessed them with large and ever-increasing families to show his power and his purpose and his goodness, so he blesses us even when we're disobedient. Our churches may flounder, indulge all the gimmicks, do all the wrong things, commit all the mistakes of the Israelites, and yet God will still save souls, still comfort them when they gather, still answer their prayers. He's doing his part. But we don't say, because he's blessing us, we can't be wrong, we can't be mistaken, we can't be off track. We hear his blessings as his call to us to reform and obey and purify ourselves. That's how it ought to be. That's the first chapter of the book of Exodus, the book of escape, the way out. Let's close singing together the hymn number 466.